Hey, resilient recruiters, here's reason number two why you must attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. And that is the keynote presentations. You'll gain exclusive insights from other top billing recruiters and entrepreneurs who've either scaled their own desk or built multi-seven-figure businesses. I myself will, of course, be one of the speakers, but the presentations that I am the most excited about are not professional speakers and trainers, but other recruitment business owners like you who will be unpacking their most effective tactics and strategies. No theory, just practical insights from people who are in the trenches, ordinary people achieving extraordinary results. There's still time to take advantage of the early bird pricing. By the way, it's happening on September 17th and 18th. So don't miss out. Reserve your place now at recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby. I'm delighted to be joined today by Sarah Demmer. Sarah is the CEO at SF Group, a specialist recruitment firm headquartered in the Midlands. Since 1998, SF Group has placed over 40,000 people, and they've been recognized as one of the top 20 companies to work for in the UK. Sarah joined SF Group in 2018. Previously, she was the UK CEO and CFO at Ignata, where she played a key role in building the group to over 40 million in revenue. Her knowledge of recruitment and talent solutions was honed during 6 years spent at Deloitte with their M&A strategy team, where she was involved in a number of high-profile deals in the recruitment sector. Sarah, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. So I heard about you through James Kahn, who's been on the show. How do you know James?
Yes, I was introduced to James 7 years ago through an ex-colleague. He was looking for somebody who had a background in recruitment, M&A and strategy. And I was one of the rare people in a transaction services background who fitted the bill. So we got talking and that's how I came to work with him.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that story. So you started your career at Deloitte and in the M&A strategy team. How did that lead to joining the recruitment industry?
So as many people in recruitment talk about, I just fell into it. Even though I wasn't in recruitment at the time, I somehow found myself falling into it. I came to the M&A world fresh from university, didn't know a whole lot about any particular sector, which is one of the beauties of being in an environment like Deloitte, where you get exposure to lots of different industries, lots of different business, leadership types, growth strategies. And one of my very first clients was a big recruitment business at the time. They were called Air Energy back then, they're Air Swift now. And they were going through their very first management buyout, private equity backed. And I was fortunate enough to have been part of the team. So I learned a huge amount. It's my kind of entry into recruitment, really, that first deal. And then as the business was growing and we were doing more and more work in recruitment, of course, having had that first experience of that first deal, I then worked on the next one and the next one and the next one. And back in those days, it was when the private equity world had really started piling into recruitment. It was, you know, the hot asset that everybody wanted. There was lots of money to be made. It was growing fast. And so I worked on some of the biggest, fastest growing deals at the time in oil and gas, in healthcare, in education, professional services. And there were a number of private equity houses that were quite prolific in the sector who I did multiple deals with. So, yes, the typical recruitment story in many ways happened by accident, but I'm glad it happened the way it did.
Fantastic. So then you made the switch from a big corporate into an investing firm. So how did that work out?
So I got to a point where I just decided I fancied doing it for myself, made the jump from a huge big corporate where, you know, everything's taken care of, it's a machine, you're very much a cog in the wheel, to a much, much smaller fund that was at the very beginnings and it was building. And actually the thing that always sticks in my mind as being the biggest challenge on day one was being shocked to discover that there was no stationery cupboard. I couldn't get my head around how a company could not have a stationery cupboard. And the lady who was our team assistant would ask me, what do you want? And I'd say a pen, and she'd just find a pen from a table and hand it to me. And I'd say, but where did the pen come from? And I think once I got my head around the fact that in a smaller environment, you create things from nothing, and that, you know, there isn't the structure, there isn't a person to do everything, you're it. You know, I remember it, that was kind of day three, it all kind of dawned on me. So a bit of a culture shock. But then, you know, once I settled into it, actually, you know, almost eight years later, it's a much more fulfilling and exciting environment to be in, probably.
Amazing. So what were some of the challenges you faced having gone from that big corporate cog in a machine into an investment firm, much smaller, more entrepreneurial? You know, obviously you're a, that must have been quite a learning curve for you. What were some of the early challenges?
Yeah, so a couple of things, really. I think in an entrepreneurial environment, when it's all on you, I often say that the highs are very high, but the lows are very low, because when it goes well, you did it. When it goes badly, you did it. And not everybody's cut out for that. Now, for me personally, one of the reasons I loved being in the M&A world was because it was very roller coaster like, you know, work really long, really late hours, big push to get a deal over the line, and then you relax for a week or so, and then you go again, and it's ups and downs. But that roller coaster, the highs became even higher and the lows became even lower. The learning curve in terms of you doing everything. I first arrived as head of M&A, but I was doing the marketing, I was doing sales, I was doing all sorts of things. And being able to, you know, keep your brain focused on so many different things and do them well is quite a challenge, but you get used to it quite quickly, and of course you adjust. And then I think the second thing, really more from a personal perspective, was around coming into an environment where everybody was an entrepreneur, and I came with this corporate badge, and I looked and sounded corporate, and I had a degree from Oxford, and I'd been to Deloitte, and I looked very different to a lot of the entrepreneurs who had, some of them had gone to university, some of them had started straight from school, started their own businesses, had been doing that grind for a while in a very different way than I had. And coming into an environment like that and winning people over and showing how I could add value to them and how I could help them to be even more successful than they already were, it definitely took, you know, a lot of charm, a lot of personality, a lot of determination to say, I know there's value I can add here, and I'm determined to show you, so that you give me permission to be part of your world. And that takes time. You know, in any people environment, you've got to work hard at those relationships. You've got to earn your stripes especially when you're new into any business. Yes, we got there, and once I had, you know, really settled into it, I found there was a lot more of the inner entrepreneur in me than I'd maybe recognized back in the early stages of my career.
Fantastic. So let me just make sure I understand. You were working with portfolio companies, mm-hmm. is that
right?
Yeah. And what was your role? What were you there to do?
Yeah, so I had a few different roles. To begin with, I was just buying businesses to create a group. Once we created the group, I was promoted up to CFO. So, of course, you know, financial responsibility there, but I'm not a trained accountant by background. So it was less of a financially focused role and much more around creating shareholder value, creating growth, all of the things, you know, that people that own businesses care about, that's going to ultimately make the money, create that wealth for them. And I became quite operational over time as well. So supporting them to set their businesses up in the right way, supporting them to think about how to best invest limited funds, limited time, limited resources to get the best return, to get the best outcome, get them as close to their own longer term goals as they wanted to. And then the third piece of that, really, I was promoted into being UK CEO, so the UK portfolio of Ignata. And at that point, I had six different businesses who I was working with in a very similar role, but much more all-encompassing then. So it went from not just being around creating shareholder value. Then at that point, it was around people, around talent attraction, around brand growth, you know, still a lot of the same things about how do we make smart investment decisions? How do we structure ourselves in the right way to grow at the pace that we want to and grow in the way that we want to. So I feel like I've really been on a journey, actually, all the way from, you know, very, very targeted support of entrepreneurs through to a bit of a wider remit that was, you know, finance plus, and then really to moving into, you know, just the full package of the million and one things it takes to run a business successfully and really being that coach and mentor for those people, because, you know, a lot of them knew their businesses extremely well, had done a great job, and they just were looking for somebody that would come in as that, you know, outside help, a fresh pair of eyes, somebody to bounce off. I think a lot of people, the more senior they get, can feel like they should know all the answers and that they shouldn't need anybody else. But actually, the higher up you go, the lonelier it gets, and the almost the more important it is that you have those voices, you have those people that you trust, you have the person that you can just ring and swear and complain because you've had a bad day and let off that steam, who's on your side and who you trust and you know that it's a safe environment. And so so that's what the role became. And then after that, I then moved into the role that I'm in today, running Just SF. So went from a portfolio role into a bit more hands-on into one of the businesses that had previously been in my portfolio.
Oh, see. Okay. That all makes sense, how that's how that's worked out. Fantastic. So since you've been with SF for, is it 4 years now?
Yeah.
Thereabouts. I know that one of the things that you're really passionate about is employee engagement, and that is demonstrated in the awards that you guys have won. Talk to me about what that means at SF and how you have promoted employee engagement.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's important to tell a bit of the history of this, actually. So when I first started working with SF, it was a very traditional business. It was run like a bit of a machine. We used to hire lots of graduates. Some of them worked out, some of them didn't, you know, as is the case in most recruitment businesses that hire graduates. And, you know, like a lot of the recruitment businesses that had done very well in the, you know, early 2000s, the 2010s, it was quite KPI driven, quite rigid. You come in at a certain time, you do what's expected, you go home, not much flexibility. And for me, having grown up in an environment where as a consultant, you know, day one, you're fresh out of university, you're handed a laptop and a phone and told that the world is your hot desk, go and make money. It felt quite alien to me. And I knew that once I had made that switch into an entrepreneurial environment, the thing that was really helping me to get the best out of myself and what had worked really well for me with other businesses and entrepreneurs I'd worked with was lifting the lid, taking the shackles off, creating that intellectual freedom, that physical freedom, giving people the autonomy to make choices. Even if they don't choose different things than what you'd already asked them to do, it was them that chose it. And that empowering of people unlocks a whole different level of performance. And I personally feel very passionately that, you know, I would never want to go back to a, you know, big corporate's a great training ground. But if you are somebody who has that entrepreneurial flair in you, it's not the place that gets the best out of you. And so with a starting point of people who do have that entrepreneurial flair in them are the bulk of what we have in SF. So let's cater to that audience. With that as a starting point, we started the process in 2018 when I first joined to really turn the business on its head. But with any culture change, it takes time. So when COVID came along, it actually gave us a catalyst to do what we had started to do, but, you know, really speed up the process, rip the plaster off and just make it happen in one go. So what did we do? We did away with a lot of the structure. So we now have work wherever, whenever, however, the choice is yours. You've got to deliver, you've got to do your job. But how you do that, if you can do your job and be successful by only working 2 hours a week, then good for you. You're brilliant. Only work the 2 hours. That's fine. Some people, you know, I know personally, I tend to get into a zone around 5 to 7 p.m. So I tend to start a bit later in the morning and I kind of get really into things at that time. If that's how you need to work, that's fine. The choice is yours. And all of the things in and around that, that, you know, lots of businesses have done now since the flexibility that has come because of COVID. So that was really the first thing. But then the next thing was taking the intellectual shackles off. And that's been the really important change in the business, is to stop telling people how to do their job. You know, there's that old adage, isn't there, about why hire people who are smarter than you and then tell them what to do. It's very much around, we have very experienced, talented people in our business. So let's let them go and do whatever they want. Let's let them behave in the way that they would behave if it was our own business. And let's stop being a one size fits all. Let's create a collection of small mini businesses within a business and give that autonomy to the individual managers, directors, managing directors to lead their teams in the way that works for them. And, you know, when you lift the lid in that way and people have been working in an environment where they haven't had that for a long time, it can be a bit daunting, actually, and it takes people time to warm up into it. You know, when we've asked people for what do you want to do differently, they've not necessarily known the answer to begin with. And then 3 months later, they come back to you having learned how to use their newfound freedom. And suddenly they've got a list of 20 things that they feel incredibly passionate about and they've always wanted to do. They just weren't used to actually having to use their brain to think about it. So that's been the next step, you know, really tapping into that intellectual freedom. And then the final thing has been backing that up then with real, you know, putting our money where our mouth is. We've introduced an employee ownership scheme. So every single person in the business has a stake in the profits. And that's, you know, right from top to bottom, regardless of seniority, tenure, job title, anything, absolutely everybody has it. And we have created what we call the SF Experience, which is our employer brand. The aim is to tick every possible box that somebody could be looking for within their employer. A great environment to be successful. You know, do I look around and see people who are talented, people who I want to learn from, people who bill more than I've ever billed, people who I think can teach me how to do similar things to what they've done. Is this an environment where I'm going to be well rewarded? You know, particularly in recruitment, yes, it's important to enjoy your job, but it's a very highly financially driven sector. So we've got to be paying top quartile, which we do. We're very transparent about that with our people as well. We do regular benchmarking. And then finally, do I actually have a life at the end of it all to go and enjoy this success and this money? Because if I'm doing brilliantly, but I never see my family and I only get, you know, 20 days of holiday, well, then what's the point of it all? So, you know, really making sure we've got generous packages across the board and leaving people in a situation where all of their major needs are met. For us, that's what a truly employee-centric model is. It's putting our people's needs first so that they're at their best. And then in turn, they will make sure that the service they're providing to our clients and candidates is also at its best. You know, because we all know what a difference it makes when you're dealing with a happy person versus a not happy person. So it's worked brilliantly for us so far. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. We've been growing really well, and the productivity has really improved on the back of those changes as well.
Amazing. I love that story. Thank you for sharing it. I did a poll on LinkedIn recently to find out what fee percentage recruiters charge, and it confirmed what I'd learned from speaking with so many recruiters every day. The majority of recruiters are undervaluing their service and cutting their fees to become more competitive. Listen, if you want to protect your cash flow and build reserves to protect your business against whatever might happen in the future, you need to be earning more for each placement, not less. The challenge, of course, is how to increase your fees and still be competitive. iIntro has helped hundreds of recruiters to make small but critical adjustments to the way they pitch and win business so they can win more clients who are also willing to pay higher fees. For example, one of their clients typically earned £5,000 per placement, but just a few weeks after working with iIntro, she won a new piece of business on a retainer, so in other words, she got a deposit, and her fee was an incredible £20,000, four times her average. If you'd like to see how iIntro can help you to grow your recruitment business and increase your average fees, just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained and book a free consultation. There's no obligation. And if you mention that you're a listener of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, iIntro have pledged to offer you a 25% discount off any of their services. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained to get started. I read somewhere that you've had a 60% uplift in productivity, but I didn't really know what that meant or how that was measured.
I'm not sure if 60% is the right number, but in the headline terms, when I first joined in 2018, the average that we were operating at was around 8K per person per month. And we didn't actually include new people in that back then. So it was probably, the true average is probably a bit lower. Today it's running at 18K per person per month. And that does include every individual in the business. So even if somebody just joined this month, they're included in that. So as you can see, I think the 60% might have been on an annual basis, but more than doubling in three and a bit years. Obviously,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, we're very pleased with that. And it didn't all happen at once. It's gone up, gently each year, 8 to 10 to 13, and then, a big jump this year to 18.
Got it. So we're talking about productivity as measured by, gross profit per employee something like that. Yeah, fantastic. So the employee share ownership scheme is brilliant. I'd like to learn more about the SF experience, but you quickly skimmed over work when, where, and how you want. What does that, in a practical sense, what does that really look like on a day-to-day basis for the employees at SF?
Every business has its own personality, right the way through from the way the office spaces look, the way that they design their time, their days, and the choices that they make about how they want to work. So as a blanket rule across the company, you can work in the way that's best for you. But because we are all social creatures and salespeople, like to be in an environment together, there's obviously lots of benefits to having the team in the office together. They've all chosen different structures. So one business has everybody in on a Monday, and then the rest of the week it's up to them. So in that business, a lot of the younger ones like to come in, partly because they probably don't have as big homes where they can get lots of private space to work. They like being around other people. They might not have families yet, so they want to come in and make friends. Sometimes when we've got new people who've joined, the managers and the teams will come in and really, kind of put that arm around and make sure that they feel there's an environment, but it's flexed as we go. Then we've got other businesses that will come in every Tuesday and Thursday and not any other days. And it's a whole mix of spectrums, really, based on what works for each team. And then within that, if there's a particular week when in the office where people come in on a Monday, somebody can't, or, we've had instances where someone's got a wedding they're going to next week and they want to make sure they definitely don't catch anything that would stop them from going, then they don't come. They just zoom in. It's very, very flexible, but with a structure around it that keeps bringing people back together so that we don't lose those connections.
So it's very much outcome focused rather than, how many hours you're working. That's what's rewarded and focused on. There's a really good book by Dan Pink called Drive. And one of the most important factors in what truly motivates people is that autonomy and, feeling like they have control, they can make decisions about what they, the work they're doing, how they do it, when they do it, and all that sort of thing. So it makes total sense to me. I guess if someone then is, what do you do in a case where someone though isn't performing to the level that, you've both agreed that they're aiming for, then does that then change the parameters, or do you have more structure in place for someone like that? How does that really pan out? Because I can also see like an experienced person who's got their client base, they're well established, they great market knowledge, and I can see that working well. But for someone who's earlier in their career, where they may be having more peaks and troughs and they're still really learning, I would have thought they do need more guidance, more structure, more direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we've been quite fortunate so far that the situation hasn't arisen yet. Now, we're not daft enough to think that it won't. And in that situation, I think, you know, with anything, you've got to dig down and see and understand what's really the root of the issue. Because we're bringing people together quite regularly and because our induction programs are deliberately designed to give people more face-to-face time at the beginning so that they can have that experience of learning by osmosis, as, you know, a lot of people did early in their careers. We do have that wraparound care. We do have regular touch points. We do have the structure in place. It hasn't happened yet, so it's difficult to answer the question. But I think if we felt that the flexible working and not being in the office was the driver, we would do something about that on a temporary basis until we fix the problem. But I think from experience, it tends to be a whole load of other things. And, you know, often it comes down to the drive and the focus and the understanding that the person has of what they're trying to achieve and how best to get there that usually is the root of the problem. And some of that can be solved by being in and around other people and seeing how they do it. But as you know, a lot of the solution is down to the individual just going away and putting 100% in. So I suspect if and when it does happen, it will be a combination of different things that we need to do. But you know, if you were to ask me, would we ever completely take the flexibility away? No, because I'm a firm believer that, you know, as you just said, people are at their best when they are able to make choices. So you take that away from somebody and I think you make them less likely to be successful. You just have to help them to understand where the parameters are, that they need to use that flexibility within so as to not hamper their own success.
Okay, I guess that makes sense. I am a firm believer in knowing your numbers. I think I find metrics incredibly helpful and valuable in order to manage and optimize my own performance. And I'm just wondering if to what extent, when you're saying you don't impose KPIs, but to what extent do you enable people to, you know, to measure the sort of leading indicators and the milestones that result in the placements and the billings?
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny one, actually. I think in most businesses, the leadership would say that they're constantly focusing on the KPIs and the team maybe not paying so much attention. It's probably the opposite way around for us. We're very outcome and results focused, but our team are, you know, smart enough and experienced enough to understand that you don't get the outcome and the results without the inputs. And so, you know, they've all been working in their markets for a long time and they know this is what I need to do each week. I need this many meetings. I need this many calls. I need, you know, this many interviews and jobs on. And they will hold themselves to account on that, you know, within reason, with the flexibility that, you know, if I didn't do it 1 week, I'm not going to beat myself up as long as I'm averaging out over a month and a quarter. But I think because many people who are successful in recruitment, as you say, they have that very rigorous, structured approach. It's almost happening of its own accord and self-managing. And of course, it comes back to hiring the right type of people who do think that way and do understand it. But when you have those people and you can entrust them to, I suppose, KPI themselves, then it all takes care of itself, really. And, you know, it sounds easy. And sometimes, you know, if somebody's having a tough time and they've lost their way a bit, it does take somebody else to just sit down with them and say, right, let's think this through. What are you doing at the moment? Talk me through how you're spending your time. And sometimes people do lose sight of it because, you know, we're all human. And sometimes you need a different voice just to, you know, tap you back in the right direction. But again, you know, if you've got people who are being given trust and behaving with maturity and know to come and ask and say, I'm losing my way a little bit here. Can you give me a hand? And of course, you know, as a leadership team, it's our job to spot those moments as well and be ready, waiting to provide the assistance when people ask for it, then generally, you know, you can get people back on track quite quickly. But you're right, you know, the KPIs are, well, let's say the activity, it's always there underneath the surface. It just doesn't necessarily need to be managed and measured in a rigorous way anymore.
Got it. All right, that's cool. So then you talked about the SF experience, and obviously there's the financial remuneration element of that. But what are some other elements that encompasses?
Well, I'll just consult my glossy brochure. So this, okay. This is the SF experience.
Cool.
So, I mean, first thing to say is we actually put together a dedicated employer brand. Looks completely different. Like you can see, it looks nothing like our normal branding. This is, I suppose, partly to show the level of commitment that we have to our employee experience. But a few different things, really. I mean, as I said, the first thing and the most important thing is being an environment where people can be successful. We're a high performing team. Our top billers are very experienced. They generate a lot of business for other team members as well, so that people coming in can really hit the ground running, get up to speed. We're part of a wider portfolio that has very high performing people as well. So it's quite common that people will come to us and say, you know, I'm a top biller in my business. I do 250 to 300K a year. And well, you know, that's just, you know, right in the middle of average in our business. So it starts with being able to show people that this is an environment where the bar is high and you will learn and you will be successful. We have really good tenure as a result of that. You know, people come in and of course, when you're earning money and you're doing great things, then you stay. So average is 7 years across our 80 people. Everybody bills, which is another driver of that high performance culture. And you know, not to keep talking about autonomy, but that is one of the biggest drivers. And I think we do that in a way that it is genuinely has an impact on people's ability to succeed, because it's one thing to have flexibility around working hours, but giving that intellectual autonomy and freedom is quite a different thing. And that's really foundation number one. Yes, as I said, earnings, you know, there's lots of things there. Top quartile earnings is a commitment that we've made to all of our people. We regularly benchmark and adjust our packages to make sure that we stay there. Very generous parental leave. We've recently launched a flexible maternity leave as well, which is something that it's an option. Some women like the idea of it, some women don't. I did it personally myself so that I could still take my 6 months maternity leave, but spread it over the course of 18 months to use it in the time and the way that suited me. We have generous what's it called when the fathers go off? Paternity leave, yeah.
Yeah.
Lost that one. We've got a 0% gender pay gap. As I mentioned, we've got the employee ownership scheme. You know, lots of great benefits that I won't bore you with. 31 days holiday, tons of stuff that, you know, lots of businesses, you know, have some of these things, but I think having the full package together of not only giving people that great work-life balance, but also being in an environment where they will earn more money than they've ever earned, and because they're billing more and they're achieving more, I think it's the combination of the things together that makes it interesting for people.
Love that. That's really cool. Tell me, like, the intellectual freedom that you mentioned, what happens in a case where somebody, where let's say the leaders or the managers disagree with the direction someone wants to go, yeah. Right? They're like, I'm going to do this. Yeah. And, you know, you're thinking, I don't think that is going to work out. Mm-hmm. Then what happens? You just let them make the mistake or figure it out. And then if it works, then great. And if it doesn't, then you reassess.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you have to get in an environment like this, you have to be very good at coaching. And again, that's been a very important change in the way that we run the business. We don't tell anymore. We coach and we guide and we mentor. And, you know, it's happened on more than one occasion where somebody's come to me or to one of the MDs or to one of the directors and said, I want to do X and here's why. And we'll ask questions. What do you think about this? What's your plan to mitigate the risk it creates over here? And I would honestly say that 90% of the time, they have actually thought about a number of things. And I think that sometimes when you have to be very aware as a leader that you're not always the best at answering something, you're not always the best judge of something. And there've been more than one occasion when, as a top team, we've been, you know, scratching around trying to think of something. And then we've gone to the next layer down and said, what do you think? And they've suddenly come up with a load of ideas that you think, oh, wow, we would have never thought of that because we don't have the perspective you have because we don't work with the, you know, the team that you work with. So there are some good judgments there. And there have been instances where somebody has wanted to do something that I categorically think is wrong. And I have guided them. I have suggested. When the coaching hasn't got them to the answer that I've wanted, I've told them, this is my opinion. However, I am backing your judgment here and you have my blessing. Go off and make it successful. Prove me wrong. So when push comes to shove, unless it's something crazy, you know, or something that's going to undermine the quality of our business or damage our people or our customers, which, you know, it isn't because we've got, you know, sensible people. But unless it was something crazy, we will always back the judgment of those individuals that we're giving that trust to because, you know, let them prove us wrong. And if they don't prove us wrong and it turned out that we were right, well, then they've learned a lesson, haven't they? And they've got that experience. And then one day when they've got somebody coming to them saying a similar thing, they'll be the person providing that coaching and having that lived experience from themselves. And I see it all as part of the learning curve. If you don't let people fail, then how are they ever going to learn? How are they ever going to get to the stage where, you know, they can be giving that advice to the next layer down?
Absolutely. 100%. So in terms of this doubling of the average billings over a 3-year period, were there any other, apart from creating this culture, like a coaching culture and empowering people, you know, giving them that autonomy and the support, which then, you know, inspires them to want to like to perform at their peak. Were there any other changes or strategies that you implemented that have contributed to that result?
Yeah, a few. We've made a more concerted effort to move up the food chain in terms of the seniority of roles that we work on. So we launched an executive business in January 2020. So, you know, into their third year now, and, you know, they are up to being about 10% of the business in terms of net fee income. So that's had some impact. Obviously, as we've created an environment where people can grow and develop, they've also moved up the seniority of their desks, working, you know, tracking as their candidates develop, you know, tracking up with them as well, which then obviously helps increase each of those individuals' average fees. But I think that the final piece, in, you know, in addition to that autonomous environment, has really been about capitalizing on and celebrating successes. When people believe that something is possible, they put a different amount of energy into trying to make it possible for themselves. So, you know, back to that point about being in a high performance environment, when you see somebody else doing something brilliant, you know it's possible and you want to do that and you want to try, and then you succeed, and then the person next to you thinks, oh, hang on, Bob's doing it, maybe I can have a go. And so you only need one success that you celebrate and you shout about and you publicize. And I think we've got quite good over the years at really getting the right groups of people together and sharing stories and saying, oh, go and talk to that person because, you know, they just did something you might be interested in, and inspiring people, not through trying to be the most inspiring leadership team, because I think if all the answers come from the top and all of the role models come from the top, it gets quite boring and quite stale quite quickly. It has to come from within. People have to see their peers being successful. people they can relate to, people they're sitting next to every day, people that they're friends with who they catch up with on the weekend. And those are the stories that are the most inspiring, because they might not be the biggest or the grandest stories, but they're the ones that people can relate to and that give them that belief that they can then go and do the same. And it's lots and lots of tiny steps that all adds up to, you know, a bigger impact over the longer term.
Sarah, I love that. It's so true that, you know, people's belief in terms of what's possible has a massive impact on their performance, and, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. If you, you know, if you see, oh, well, if Sarah can do it, then, you know, maybe I can do it as well. You've got that role model, that reference that makes it possible. I've got a story about that in a second. How do you celebrate those wins and share those success stories within the business?
Yeah, lots of different ways. I'll be honest, I don't tend to go out on, you know, we've got most of the business out on a celebration this afternoon. I tend to leave them to it, not cramp their style. But, you know, lots of different layers of things. You know, we do the usual team get-togethers. Pretty much every month, we take the time to have at least an afternoon, if not a whole day out together, let off some steam, celebrate the hard work that's gone before. Lots of communications around the business as well, sharing what's going on, sharing successes. Each of our leadership teams have lots of comms that they do in their own businesses in terms of Monday meetings, Friday meetings. I think it's about constantly talking and communicating. Somebody once said to me a long time ago, you can never communicate too much. And it really is true.
Yes.
No matter how many times you say something, say it again, say it again. It can't hurt. Say it in a different way. Say it, if you sent it via an email, say it verbally next time. Mention it in a video, mention it in a face-to-face. Keep reinforcing the messages, because, each time, even if only one person of the 20 that you're talking to listens and retains it, well, that's one person that you've reached in that moment. So lots of different things. As always, in a growing business, you have to keep evolving these things. So we've actually just hired a dedicated employee engagement manager to start with us next month, whose job it will be to help us do even more of these things and create even more new ways to, you know, create that fun environment, really have that culture of celebrating successes, make this a hopefully even better place to work, because you have to keep things moving, you have to keep things fresh. And as I said earlier, when it's the leadership team doing it, well, you know, we've only got so many ideas in our brains, and once we've used them all, you have to bring in some fresh energy to mix things back up again.
Absolutely. I'm just curious how people within the business find out about those success stories. How it's, you know, is it is there an awards day, or is it like via Slack or Teams, or, you know, is it during team meetings? Like, what's the channels that these stories would be shared, so that if someone in another office or another team has done something amazing, how would I get to hear about it?
Yeah, it's a whole mixture. So we make sure that our peer groups get together across all the different businesses. So, mm-hmm. You know, if I'm a qualified finance consultant in Birmingham, I want to be getting together with all of the other people doing a similar role to me in the other regions as well, so that we're all talking about what's going on in our market. And we do that at different levels. And, you know, the managers and directors will get together, the senior management team will get together. And always the first order of business is, let's go around the room and talk about what's going on. What's good, we also share about what's not going so well. One, because other people can learn and not make the same mistakes. But two, most of the time, everyone else in the room nods and says, oh, I thought it was only me. And of course, you know, it takes some pressure off. So a lot of it is getting people together. We talk a lot in our business. I'm sure, you know, lots of recruitment firms are the same. There's just a lot of picking up the phone. Let me just tell you this. Let me just tell you that. Oh, just a quick one here. Just a quick one there. We send around a company email every month with all of the success stories. We have Monday morning meetings. It's at all different levels. You know, people retain information in different ways. And so we have to do a bit of everything to make sure that we're hitting as many people as possible.
Great. I'm such a huge believer in this, Sarah. Like in our coaching groups, we always start the meeting by celebrating wins. People need to bring an achievement to that. You know, and then someone else has just won, you know, a new retainer or achieved a personal best. And then it's like, oh, wow, how did they do that? And then there's lots of learning opportunities from that. But it also, as you say, creates this idea of what, you know, what is possible. I used to do this board breaking workshop where I would get people to like smash wooden boards with their bare hands. And it was definitely about that idea of doing something that is scary and intimidating and that, you know, maybe you've never even thought was possible before. But then once you've done it, realizing that, you know, wow, you know, what other things do I think are impossible that, you know, that I could totally do if I was, you know, if I believed in myself and pushed outside my comfort zone. And I was doing this workshop in Amsterdam once, and I asked, like, okay, who's going to go first? And the sales director, of course, like, stood up immediately because he was like, well, I'll do it. And so he came up, and then he tried, and he couldn't break the board, which, first of all, worried me because I thought, uh-oh, this whole metaphor is going to fail. After a few tries, I was like, okay, Ian, why don't you go sit down? And let's give someone else a try. Luckily, every other person then managed to break the board. And so then back to Ian, he had to break it that time. But of course, he'd just seen his whole team do it. So there was no way that that board was not going to break when, you know, he approached it the second time, because it was, you know, it was, he had all these examples, these references that it was possible. And if they can do it, then I can do it too. Sarah, what are your plans for continuing the expansion at SF?
Yes, so we are expanding geographically. We are looking for talented individuals and businesses to back in other regions. We're focusing primarily on the build out of finance and two of our newer divisions, tech and engineering. But I think the most important thing as we grow is really making sure that caliber of individuals that we're bringing on board is right, and it allows us to retain that, you know, very mature, flexible culture that we have. So that's the priority, and we'll hope that we find the right people in the right places.
And are there particular geographies or sectors that you're targeting that you want to prioritize as you're expanding? Or
We're focusing on the UK right now. We will expand internationally over the longer term, but we'd like to, we're quite heavily focused on the Midlands, so we'd like to move north and we'd like to move south. Is the obvious two directions to go in, not really anywhere else you can go. So we'll start there for now.
Okay, awesome. And so if there are listeners who are interested in, you know, learning more or being part of this, then how should they reach out?
Look me up on LinkedIn, Sarah Demmer, SF Group. I'm always happy to respond to a message.
Okay, simple. That sounds awesome, Sarah. Is there anything that you had wanted to talk about that I haven't asked you about today?
No, all good.
All right. Well, I've really enjoyed meeting you, and thank you so much. So many fantastic ideas. I've got lots of notes based on our conversation. So, well, thank you, Sarah. Have an awesome day.
Thank you. You too. See you later.